So we can get involved in our personal life, in our relationship, but also with the world that we want to express our values, maybe of social justice or, you know, a deeper understanding of our relationship to the planet that we are, nature, you know, would naturally lead to getting involved. And it's display of compassion. Compassion is action, huh? It's the wish to alleviate suffering. And so there's this compassion that arises in us. We're deeply touched by suffering, suffering that is here now and that could come, you know, depending on our actions, what we put out, how we are acting as consumers, as citizens, etc. And so there's the compassion, and it's balanced by the equanimity. Equanimity is not indifference. It's not being removed. It's not this. It's just talks about being balanced, not losing it. You know, it talks about not collapsing completely. It talks about being able to be with ethical questions, with hard decisions, with renunciation, you know, with giving up some, you know, privileges maybe, or things we might have access to, that, you know, are using our time to defend the planet or something. So being able to be balanced and then act, get involved in our life, you know, but from a place of care and love and equilibrium, rather than from a place of hate and reactivity, which is very, very depleting. So, you know, one expression that I heard from Leila F. Saad in the work around, well, in her book, Me and White Supremacy, I think it might be the subtitle of the book even, I can't remember right now, but I loved, and it might come from her or from somebody else in their lineage or in the, you know, in the, but she talks about being a good ancestor. I had never heard it before. I thought it was such a beautiful kind of view. Like being a good ancestor, knowing that, you know, our actions, the way we live, is going to have impact for generations, you know, in terms of social justice, in terms of relationship with the environment. And yeah, that kind of awareness, that kind of mindfulness, that we're not just here as a, for 80 years old as a consumer, if we're talking about environment, you know, but that this has an impact way beyond, and it can have a beautiful impact. What about leaving beautiful traces, you know, behind? And so there's something very beautiful in this. There's a kind of sense of responsibility. Yeah, so not denying agency, creativity, because we're so good. We get so good at receiving information, you know, at being touched by the world. We're getting so good. We want to get so good at being touched by the world, at taking it in with balance, so that we can get involved, participate. And also the notion of change, because that's all based around this question. The notion of change is also what makes the end of racism possible. Not easy, not easy, but possible. If there wasn't change, we would be caught in that system of white supremacy, white as supreme, you know? And because it's possible to bring new views, to reflect, to, there's movement in the mind, in the heart, and there can be movement in society. For this reason, we can end suffering, sexism, transphobia. For this reason, we can go from an industrial growth society to a life-sustaining society. And so that is what practice is for, to transform our hearts, our relationships, and to transform, you know, the society in a way that is for the benefit of everyone. Wow. Okay. Somebody else writes, how do you handle spending time with loved ones who aren't mindful and are unhappy, struggling, and are not open to mindfulness advice? This kind of relates to the metta that you suggested yesterday of letting go of your improved view of someone. Yeah, not easy, not easy. So first recognizing this, the dukkha of this, and somebody was asking a question also yesterday about how do you do when somebody is accusing you of something you haven't done? How do you hold this? It's very triggering, very uncomfortable, very disbalancing, if I can say it like this, you know? So all this to me is one theme. I see it as one theme of dukkha. Maybe we'll talk more about this today. Dukkha in Pali, as many of you know, talks about the imperfection in reality for a human being who responds really well to people doing what they want. You know, we respond really well when people do exactly what we want them to do. Yet we live in a world where things and people don't exactly go accordingly to our plans or opinions or preferences, you know. And so that's the world we're inhabiting. It's the nature of this world to not behave in the way that we would want it to behave, at least not all of the time, for sure. Huh? We would like health, and sometimes there is disease. We would like a pandemic-free planet, and there's a pandemic. We would like certainty, and there's uncertainty. You know, we would like comfort, and there is discomfort. We would like absence of conflict, and there is conflict. And so a lot of the practice is to learn to, they're going to be poor words here, but to learn to relax into this, to allow this to be felt, the powerlessness. Ooh. Oh, that takes some stability of mind. That takes some courage. That takes a lot of love and compassion to allow oneself in an experience of powerlessness, being powerlessness to have somebody make better choices, to have somebody maybe see the truth, powerlessness to, you know, eradicate something that is not good in society. And so to stay stable and vibrant, not to shut down or, you know, explode or implode, you know, when we're experiencing powerlessness is really not easy practice. Yet some of these things to me seems to be talking about this. Oh, my love, here we are. An encounter with lack of power, an encounter with separation from what would be dear. Dear. An experience of uncertainty, an experience of unresolvedness. Something is unresolved, and it cannot be resolved just now. Breathing into this, can that be known as it is? As it is. Can I have a deeper awareness of the ephemeral nature of this? What are the similarities between having somebody accuse you of something you haven't done and somebody praise you for something you have done? There's definitely differences, huh? We can see them very quickly. Somebody accusing you of something you haven't done and somebody praising you for something you have done well. Both are ephemeral. Both arise and pass. that doesn't make them equal exactly, but wisdom is inviting us to notice this. Notice this. This is an arising. There's going to be many arisings. Some will be comfortable, just, fair, and some will be unfair. Can it allow appearances to do what they do, appear and vanish? In both, there is a lack of control. Is the person praising me, you know, can I absolutely control this? Will they keep praising me? Nothing is less sure. You know, can I control that? Because sometimes I do things well and nobody notices, you know? So there's something that escapes me here. That is the nature of reality. I'm not saying any of this is easy, but with practice, there might be a kind of recognition that yes, these things will happen. There is this lack of control that I have as a human being, not easy. I could hate that, you know, that I'd have lack of control. That would add a lot of suffering. I could want control. That would add a lot of suffering. And I could recognize that a lot of the time I don't have control over what others do, say, perceive of me, of situations. Not easy. Whoa. This opening of the mind is a huge stretch. It's breaking the heart open. Wow. I won't be able to, you know, have people change their perception of me or of what's happening in the world. There's a practice, I haven't done it lately. I think it's kind of integrated. That's what happens with these things, I think. But for a long time, a practice of equanimity I would do would be to think of somebody in my family or in my work environment or in my friends, you know, somebody that was not making the best choice for them and maybe for me also, you know, and I would just spend a lot of time just thinking of this person and saying, I give you back your life. It's your life, your choices, your perceptions, your pace. You go at your own pace. You take care of yourself. You decide what you do, you know? Because I could see in me a certain kind of violence of wanting to have people be different than what they are. And I could see that I needed to actually step back a bit and recognize my lack of control, you know? Of course, you'll perceive the situation as you do. I can try to offer some tips here, you know, enter into a conversation, but you are sovereign. Can I say that like this? So, you know? And I don't want anybody to force me into seeing something, you know, or anything. I want to make the, you know, I want to go at my pace, you know. I want to make my decisions. It's not easy what I'm talking about, but to me, I gained a lot of, yeah, I regained balance in doing this. And now I say it's more integrated because sometimes as the situation is happening, there's an awareness, oh, Pascal, here, you have very limited control over this, you know. And you might maybe set boundaries, say your truth, you know, invite reflection, but that's all like small things, you know. Can it be okay? Because that's how the world is. The Buddha is talking about an unconditional freedom, a freedom that doesn't depend on you know, reorganizing somebody else's thoughts, you know, or views or opinions or perceptions. Not easy. So I think maybe the last thing on this would be that all calls for a lot of compassion for oneself, you know. Not easy. Not easy being in this situation where I don't have control. So an appropriate response for me is a lot of compassion, a lot of tenderness. Maybe for the other one, if we can, you know, muster that. But certainly for self. Oh, Pascal, not easy right now for you. You won't be able to have it your way here. Even though it would be good for everyone, you know. It might not happen like this. Compassion, courage, patience, acceptance, and creativity, you know. Because when our mind has more capacity to recognize what's happening and be centered, then the mind has fluidity. It can suddenly see solutions where there seem to be no solutions, you know. Anyway, things like this. I'm a senior with continuous and ongoing health issues which are preventing me from carrying on with life as I had known it. I alternate between sadness and anger, of course, and I'm aware of these emotions when they arise. Sometimes my mind embellishes them. Sometimes I attempt to abandon them, take wise action to distract myself. I've never come to joy or compassion with this. Can you say more about how those arise? Thank you. The birth of joy, the arising of joy, and the birth or the arising of compassion. Well, it says in the teaching, as you might know, that compassion is the trembling of the heart when there's a, I'll put it this way, a high quality contact with what is difficult. A really high quality contact with what is difficult. We know about poor quality contact with what is difficult. It's very natural for us. It happens a lot, you know. We collapse, we blame, we get charged, we get confused, we freeze, we, of course, you know, of course, absolutely, very natural. And there's a way, apparently through practice, this one, or maybe other practices, you know, there's not just one way, you know, but through these practices, there's a way to have a quality, a connection, contact with what is difficult for ourselves or for others, where what is born of this contact, you know, the juice that comes up with, you know, between the contact between the difficult and the a conscious being, you know, where it could be aggressions or collapsing, like there's a possibility of this alchemy where love can arise, care, tenderness. And that's very mysterious. And the practice is to find out about this. For me, the way it has unfolded, I think, is through receiving the instructions from the teachers, our dear teachers, again and again, you know, very patiently, saying, can you actually know this? Can it be experienced just as it is? And learning to actually be more, have more capacity to be with what is uncomfortable. Separation from what is dear for myself, from others, not turning away, not getting worried, but just being there, being there, like a contact, touching. And I think it's from that regular and of more and more quality contact that I could see how, care would arise, a wish for well-being, you know, that is not contracted, but I wanted to try to, that crossed my mind a couple of days ago as I was practicing, and this retreat actually, I was interested in talking about it, like exploring it in terms of Vedana. It's a Pali word. So this is my personal research here. So there's something happening. It's uncomfortable or unpleasant, disagreeable. So the word in Pali, Vedana, which is the tonality, every experience we have has a little tonality of being either pleasant or unpleasant, or maybe neither one or the other, but it comes with life. Huh? Do you agree with this? That some things we experience, it's pleasant to taste, maybe. Some tastes or sounds are pleasant. Some are not pleasant, and some, they don't stand out in this way. Yeah. So when we encounter difficulty, often it's experienced as unpleasant. Huh? Do you agree with this? Difficulty in the lower back, in the knee, in the relationships, you know, in the mind, confusion, fear. Many of these things are disagreeable. And what I'm surprised about, I've never put this in words exactly, what I'm surprised about or that I'm interested in is how compassion has, to me, a kind of, I almost want to say pleasantness to it, because it's love, you know, it's love. And it's as if what is difficult is the balm of compassion comes over it, and it soothes, and it makes it more possible to be with what is difficult, because on the layer of what is unpleasant, there's a layer added of what is beautiful. Let's put it like this, maybe beautiful. And it makes it possible to thread or be with what is unpleasant, because the mind is maybe surrounded, or the heart, or the experience is surrounded with love, you know, and it holds it in this way. The opposite of that is that there's something difficult happening, and it seems like it can be multiplied, made even more difficult by a layer of judgments, or, you know, how we anticipate and project and speculate, you know, like, this is bad, it's going to get so much worse, or if it stays for the rest of my life. And so there's something difficult, and unknowingly, maybe we add the layer of difficulty, the second arrow, and it makes it really difficult, unbearable, maybe even. Yeah. But compassion is that, we could see it maybe like this, is that layer of loveliness that comes. And in this way, the mind can be refreshed, maybe, even in the middle of difficulty. Equanimity is this layer of, it's not so much pleasant as neutral. It holds things in a more neutral way. So it goes from being really unpleasant to being a little bit more neutral. Oh, this is how it is right now. I don't know, I'm playing with these. But how is it born? Well, I said a few words here, and then it's for us to find out more. And about joy, I'll just say, joy has so many ways to be born. In Buddhist psychology, oh my God, we should do a weekend just around that. There's so many pathways to joy. There's the pathway of appreciation. So in regard to aging and losing some of the maybe abilities or the ways that we were, you know, I'm just thinking, could there be sometimes, you know, it's not always accessible, all these paths, but could there be appreciation, gratitude for what was possible in the past, you know, that for so many years there was the ability to do this or that, that is not there. I'm not sure if it's possible, but I would definitely be intrigued. And I know I would need a certain kind of mind to be able to go in that direction, you know, to rejoice about this. Joy I found through practice, and I'm so thankful for this. I didn't know so much about this. That's really like thanks to Buddhism, I think, here. That is a kind of contentment that can arise by being fully present to something very simple. Sometimes it's a beautiful thing that appears to us, like perceived as beautiful in and of itself, you know, like smelling the roses, you know, or seeing something of nature that is beautiful. I think it's enhanced by the quality of presence, you know, because I can be like, oh my God, it's so beautiful, where's my camera? You know, and then, you know, something's lost here. But if there is some amount of calm and knowing that the quality of the connection, like, what is beautiful is enhanced. And that's Dhammadina at the time of the Buddha, a woman practitioner who was very loved and respected. And she would say, you know, with things that are rather neutral, or at least that's the way I understand her discourse there, what she says. What I understand is she says, when something is rather neutral, if we meet it without mindfulness, it easily becomes disagreeable. You know, oh, there's nothing happening. Why is my life so boring? You know, and when it's met with a quality mind, mindful mind, what is rather neutral can easily become pleasant and a source of enjoyment, of joy. And I've seen this in practice so many times, you know. I remember at the beginning, be with your breath. This is so boring. I'm going to die here of boredom, you know. Because the breath is rather neutral for me, at least, often. And with the mind getting more quiet, more being able to be intimate with experience, suddenly, just an in-breath becomes somewhat enjoyable. Or silence become enjoyable. And many things like this, just being with the toes or with the light at this time of day. So there's contentment maybe possible in and really good maybe when you're aging and you can't, you know, go mountain biking as you used to, you know, with your fat tires, you know, and now you're 87 and it's not recommended because of the osteoporosis to go mountain biking. But then there is light. There is hands resting. So there's many, many avenues of contentment maybe that are hidden that could reveal themselves. In the same way, I remember Kumi Naido, who used to be, if I say his name right, I hope so, we used to be the director of Greenpeace a number of years ago. And I was on a meeting with him, many people, you know, just me and Kumi. But I was on a meeting and he was talking and we were saying, it was a bunch of Buddhists thinking about our contribution to, you know, the crisis on the planet. And he was saying, I think what you could bring, you Buddhists, is you can teach people how to be contented with more simplicity. This could make a huge, imagine a whole world starting to tune in to little things and experiencing fullness, you know, instead of like, I need this, that, you know, I was conditioned to want, you know, a big this or another that or new this or, you know, all of this, you know, if all of this was let go of, the joy of renunciation, the joy of simplicity, the joy of ethics, the joy of caring, the joy of not hurting. There's so many sources of joy that don't require us to have a lot of mobility, maybe, or be that quick or efficient or whatever it is. And so I think there's a real exploration there of the sources of joy possible. Okay. Hey, I'm aware of time. I see there's a hand up, August, so sorry. Maybe you could write it to me and I can see if I can give parts of answer later this afternoon. And I see at least another question there. I'll read it for sure.